Hello, everybody. My name is Robin Harrison, and I'm here as ever with the Niles to my Fraser, Mr. Ed Birkin. Ed, how are you today?
No. That is it. We're not taking that. I mean, it is a great, great program. Not the remake, the original. But no way am I the Niles.
You are absolutely the Niles.
I would take being his dad.
No, you're not.
I'll take being his dad's dog.
You're way too fussy to be Eddie or whatever. Martin?
Was it Martin?
Yeah.
Well, Niles gets a girl in the end. Fraser just continues to live a solo, sad life.
Well, he goes back to Boston, doesn't he?
He does eventually, yeah.
He does. And funnily enough, today's guest has actually been in Boston recently for Scotland's, we'll call it a peaceful invasion.
That was almost smooth, Robin, that.
It was.
You've been listening to my segues, transitions.
I've been avoiding your segues like the plague, and that's why that one worked. Okay. But yes, very pleased to welcome Nigel Eccles onto the podcast. I mean, like, honestly, Nigel, you're a bit of a man who doesn't really need an introduction. You know, there's FanDuel, there's BetHog, there's the Ice365 studio, obviously the pinnacle of everything you've done. Mm-hmm. And so, welcome, first of
all.
So, obviously, Nigel, we've got a lot to talk about today. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think we need to kind of go back and go through your career as I said, but obviously I think what's kind of interesting is we're speaking in the wake of the court ruling about, mm-hmm. you know, about FanDuel's ownership, because obviously you founded that business. So from your side, keen to kind of get an eye, you know, get, like, well, from your
not,
kind of
not everyone who listens to this is as knowledgeable as you are, Robin, about everything.
Yeah, do you want me to give us a background?
Okay. That'll be useful.
Yeah, all right, yeah, fair enough, like, yeah.
FanDuel, and then the kind of recent court ruling. And I think, I don't even need to do it from my side, like, I think I can get sort of lay the facts and then explain the ruling. So, FanDuel today sort of is the largest sports book and casino in the U.S., I think they did about $7 billion in revenue last year. They're currently owned by Flutter Entertainment, which was previously London listed. It's actually now US and London listed. Was by market cap the largest sports betting operator in the world. I've had a pretty rough 12 months, but obviously one of the largest. Myself and four co-founders started FanDuel in 2009, originally as a daily fantasy sports site. So fantasy is a really big category in the US. And so we built that over 10 years. And then in 2018, the US changed their gaming laws. It was a law called PASPA that opened up sports betting. And so after that, FanDuel went straight into sports betting and casino. And a state-by-state rollout. So we founded the company in 2009, raised money from external investors. What happened in 2018 was the company was largely controlled by some of these late-stage investors like KKR and Shamrock. And they were looking for... they entered into a sort of a merger agreement with Flutter, where Flutter would put in its US assets, which is TVG.
Yeah, TVG.
And we would merge those two entities. And it was what you would call a paper transaction, because what we would put in is our shares in FanDuel, and what we were getting out was 40% of this new company. Confusingly, it was also called FanDuel Group. But that was sort of the combined entity. And the question then is, what is 40% of this new group, FanDuel Group, worth? And the reason that was really important was that we had, like most startups, when you raise money, you have preference shares and you have ordinary shares, common shares. And preference shares take the first X money and then everyone shares in the rest.
Yeah.
And for FanDuel at the time, we had raised about $500 million. And so we had a pref stack of $559 million. And so whenever this merger happened, PASPA got repealed, sort of in the middle of the sort of the discussion. And so the value of all of the companies that were in the US rocketed. So not long afterwards, DraftKings raised at well over $1 billion. The Score, which was traded in Toronto, I think their share price went up like 6x in one day. So you could see massive increase in value. The only place where it didn't happen was with regards to 40% of this FanDuel group, which they said, actually, the value of that 40% was $559 million. They said that was what was valued before PASPA, and that was the value still the same after PASPA. And why was it $559 million? Well, that's the magic number that wipes out those common shareholders. And so the board was controlled by the preference shareholders who said, you know what, we've got a gold mine here. Why should we share it with these, you know, employees, founders, and early investors? And so they that's what they did. And they sort of, because they controlled the board, they rammed through this transaction. FanDuel predictably went on to be very successful, and as the market kind of anticipated, and went on to sort of dominate that market. As we knew it would, and as the board themselves knew they would, they had already had projections that sports betting was going to be, you know, transformational for the business. We filed suit, by we I mean the founders and former employees. There's over 100 former employees in the suit, but we originally filed suit prior to the deal closing in Scotland. And then since then, we subsequently refiled in New York in 2020. Hmm. And then over that period of time, I've been sort of through the New York court system, which I'd say is very good. It's just very slow. And so we then refiled in 2024, we just had a judgment back. Sorry, I'll pause there, because that's the sort of the backdrop, yep. And then we can go on to the judgment.
Yeah. No, thanks for that primer. Now, in terms of, just trying to think where to kind of start, where to go with the mm-hmm. questions, because I don't want to go immediately into kind of like talking about this judgment, but I mean, like throughout that process, I mean, like what materially was lost through essentially being kind of flat out of the deal?
Well, yeah, so I can give you the simple math. The founders, common shareholders, and early investors that are involved in this suit owned about 10% of the common shares.
Right.
2 years after this merger that we talked about, where they said the value of that 40% was only $559 million, those same investors sold their stake for $4.2 billion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even there you can see this is a company that before, in 2017, was valued at $1.2 billion. A year later, after the most transformational change in the sports betting world, in the US in the last 50 years, they said it had dropped magically to $559 million, and then 2 years later was worth $4.2 billion. So that was kind of sort of a timeline. And so we are suing for 10%, and you can kind of say 10% of that $4.2 billion for simple math.
Fair enough.
So at what stage, I don't know, my background, obviously, I've been following the gambling industry for 20 years, 10 as an investment mm-hmm. research analyst, so looking at valuations is my bread and butter.
Yeah.
Done flooding and everything. And we know they went up and down. So, I mean, quite frankly, DraftKings was never worth $70 and then collapsed down. So, you know, we know this hype. But at the time, it was kind of, you know, probably actually almost worth more than it is now in terms of mm-hmm. what the valuation of Flutter would have been. At what point did you realize they were screwing you, and what was their justification? Because surely they couldn't have just said with a straight face that the most monumental thing that's ever happened in all recent time in US gambling, of PASPA being repealed, is going to have no impact on the valuation. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at other companies where you're actually seeing the valuation mm-hmm. change. Like, there must be, no offense, but there must be more to it than that. They can't just say, oh, sorry, lads, it hasn't changed, and ignore everything else around it. You know.
Wouldn't you think that to be the case? Well, so number one, we filed before the deal closed. So, you know, actually at the time, they've sort of made some case that this is Monday morning quarterbacking. Like, it was not. We actually filed before, and we said this is a fraud. we know this is a fraud. What is their what's their defense on it? Their defense is essentially what I said, is that 559 million was the value of the company, and it didn't change through PASPA. That's essentially what you can actually read their court papers, and they said no, it anticipated PASPA. Yeah.
Okay.
You can read their court. That is their argument, and that is the argument that I've seen that
okay.
making court.
When did it change? When did it close exactly?
July 2018.
Going at 1.7 billion.
Yeah, but PASPA was May that year, so it happens May, June, July. So 2 months after PASPA.
Yeah. It had no impact on the value of 40% of what looked at the time to be a clear winner, if not the winner, in online sports betting in US. They have made that argument in court, and they will repeat, they've made that argument repeatedly.
And were you still part of the operating group at the time?
No. So myself and my co-founders had really departed over the previous couple of years.
Okay.
So I had left about 6 months before.
And obviously kind of DFS, which was huge, but, you know, I don't know whether you're doing an anticipation of PASPA or just generally in the competition, but, you know, both yourselves and DraftKings were making huge losses at the time.
Yeah, we were.
Did you see... Before you left, did you have a kind of path to profitability through DFS?
Yeah, so we actually, the 2015 year was very, incredible growth year, but, you know, very loss-making. In later years, 2016, 2017, we really narrowed that loss quite dramatically, because we were no longer, putting the same amount of money into growth. We always felt that the US was an anomaly, and that anomalies usually resolve themselves. We knew that people love sports betting in the US, and they generally were doing it legally. We knew that if we built this platform, we had built a brand and a function, that if there was an opportunity to go into sports betting, we were really well positioned. And it wasn't just us that believed it, our investors believed it, Flutter believed it. That's why they went into this partnership.
Okay. And obviously a few years before that, there was the attempt to merge with DraftKings.
Yes.
And I've always been kind of intrigued by that, because obviously it was blocked by the Competition Commission, because I think it was, you would have had something ridiculous 98.9% of the market. So considering that, and considering the investment coming in, were you essentially in the process of looking to sell?
There was certainly a process in early 2018. Certainly our investors were much more keen that we find a partnership where we had a third party that would put money in, would give us sort of like a floor. I think DraftKings investors were much more keen that they sort of go for it. Mm-hmm. And it's, dependent on the outcome of the market from a financial perspective, it's still unclear which was the right strategy. Our investors did incredibly well. Even if they hadn't perpetrated the fraud, they probably would have made something like nine times their money back. It was an incredible return for them, and this was on an investment of something like 450 million. With DraftKings, to date, they've raised billions, mm-hmm. and spent even more sort of paper on acquisitions. And so I've never actually compared the return to investors for them. I actually think they're probably similar, but with DraftKings, it depends when you invested.
So just talk us through for the people who don't explicitly understand all the preference shares and common stock, mm-hmm. etc. So you've got the investors who took the 559 million and then sold it for 4.2 billion. If they'd have gone back to Flutter or the merger at the time and gone, hang on, May PASPA happened, mm-hmm. we think this is worth, say, carbon a billion, Okay, so they would have got the 559 million. You guys would have got 441 million. then what would have happened for the sale? Would you still, would you have?
Yeah, let me just sort of correct there the events. So they didn't actually have to do anything with Flutter. They didn't have to go back to Flutter and say, we need to renegotiate this, because what was negotiated with Flutter was a 60-40 split. That's all right. Flutter cared about. And in fact, Flutter got an indemnification from our board, because they saw what our board was doing and said, okay, we're going to let you do this, but you have to indemnify us from what you're doing. So there was no, that was the only sort of negotiation with Flutter. Flutter said, like, you can, it's called run the waterfall. You can value your 40% however you want. And so it was our board that made the decision unilaterally that said, okay, we're going to value it at 559. And what would have happened is they really had two options. One of the things they could have done is they could have said, we're just going to preserve our capital structure. So we're not going to, because we're just giving paper out. We're going to preserve, and this happens all the time. And then when we ultimately sell, we'll disperse the money. Alternatively, what they could have done is said, we're going to actually properly value it. We're going to use a third party, someone who's disinterested, to actually put a value on this asset. And then they would have decided what the split was based on the value in July 2018. So those are the two options open to them that they would have done and that they should have done. But instead, what they decided to do was, no, let's wipe out the common shareholders. Let's not value this, because it means that ultimately we would make less money. That's what they decided to do.
So effectively, let's say that 40% was worth the $4 billion. It's just that they wouldn't have had 100% of that. They would have had to share it with you guys.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So basically, the question is, how do you split the 40% of FanDuel Group between the two classes of shares? That's what you're trying to figure out. Okay. You actually are not at that point. You're using the number to try and figure out the split, but no one's actually getting any money.
Yeah.
No one got any money until 2 years later.
But what's quite ridiculous in this, I mean, another thing that seems quite ridiculous to me, is that, so Flutter had agreed their assets are worth 60% of the combined entity.
Right.
And yours are worth 40%. Suddenly the value of yours has skyrocketed because,
yes,
let's be honest, TVG is not worth any more, you know.
No, TVG would have, TVG similarly as a US gaming asset would have shot up in value as well.
Not to the same extent.
No, I mean, and like you think about the database, you know, and the kind of the customer base that FanDuel had as opposed to TVG.
Well, I think there's a lot of also like the expertise that Flutter brings into it, because you have to remember that, you know, FanDuel, like, we had a brand and we had a customer base, but we didn't have any expertise in sports betting. And so the merger made sense at a 60-40 prior to PASPA, but actually post-PASPA, it made more sense because suddenly we had a partner that had all of this expertise and the promise of a platform, you know, our ability to bring in a platform. If you actually, if we look at an alternative one, was to look at DraftKings. DraftKings later on then had to merge or had to acquire SB Tech to bring in some of that expertise. So no, the FanDuel side of the house did rocket in value at the same time because they did have a lot of that expertise.
Okay. I mean, I still think 50-50 would have been a fairer adjustment at that point, which would have given more across to your side, but I think it'd be a bit generous to Flutter on that.
Yeah, like, you could have, like, you know, could they have sort of like stopped the bus and said, hey, we're going to renegotiate? I think, you know, at the time, you have to sort of open back up. Like, New Jersey was coming online, so it was sort of like, I think there was a feeling on the FanDuel side is like, look, the combined asset has rocketed in value. Let's get this closed. The other thing to be clear with the board is they knew if they reopened this, they would have to share the value of the common shareholders. So they were like, let's get this closed as quickly as possible.
Okay.
Go on, Robin. I know you're dying to get on to the next bit.
Yeah, I want to talk about the ruling. So then fast forward into last week.
Yes.
Yeah, last week. So the ruling comes out. So do you want to talk us through what the court has said?
Right. So the sort of major defense from the defendants in this case, and the defendants are the the former board, minus one member who didn't vote for the deal. It's that former board, KKR Shamrock, and then some of the entities that were set up around the deal. Mm-hmm. And their primary defense was that the board did not owe a fiduciary duty to the shareholders, right? Okay. And yeah, everyone looks
surely, at me. Surely that is that the one. Board's number one, that is their number one thing, is a fiduciary duty to shareholders.
So in the UK, so in New York, 100% yes. In Delaware, 100% yes. In the UK, the board's primary duty is to owe a duty to the company and by extension, the shareholders. But it is not as clear as it is in the US that you owe a fiduciary duty directly to shareholders. So their primary defense is because Fandu Limited was a UK company, they did not owe us a direct fiduciary duty. And we fought about that in court from 2020 to 2024. So about 4 years. This sort of discussion of UK or even actually Scottish law. Hmm. Ultimately, we won on that. And we won in that they said, no, you owe a duty to the company. And in certain circumstances like this one, where you have a conflicted board, to shareholders. And so, but that was sort of the big fight for the first 4 years. Hmm. After that, we then refiled, and we had already done a lot of discovery. So during that period, we were in discovery, so we had got a lot of emails and text messages. In 2024, we then refiled with the court, and it's confusingly known as the New York Supreme Court. New York Supreme Court is sort of the lowest court. It's not like the federal system. The Supreme Court's a top court. But it's a commercial division. They handle multi-billion-dollar suits, but it's the Supreme Court. It's not the top one. It's sort of the bottom in the structure. So we refiled with the Supreme Court, and we filed 10 claims, including breach of fiduciary duty, which is the core one. What does that mean? Is that they had a duty to us as shareholders. They breached it. They lined their own pockets. We had charges of fraud because they made statements to us that were untrue and that caused us harm. We had charges of bribery in that they gave incentives to board members to get them to vote for the deal. Mm-hmm. And we had charges of conspiracy. Yeah. So they, as entities together, conspired in order to complete this deal to basically effectively steal the shares from the common shareholders. So those were the sort of their 10 claims in there. Mm-hmm. And that's what went in front of the court 2 years ago. That was briefed. And then we had a hearing last August, so about 12 months ago. And we had the ruling 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
And it was 8 of the 10.
Correct, yeah. Through, so. 8 of the 10, the court side is not. This is a motion to dismiss on their side. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly not the end of the journey. Mm-hmm. And in a motion to dismiss, what the court has to say, the court is deciding whether we have legal grounds for these claims, not whether these claims are true, because that comes later on, but whether, and they have to infer that the facts support us, right? The court will says we are deciding whether, if these facts are true, we have claims. And what the court found for 8 of the 10, including all of the main ones of breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, bribery, and conspiracy, they found that we have a legal path to win of those, and that and so it's basically found in our favor. And so they knocked out two sort of our smaller ones around breach of contract and another one. I actually forget that one. So mm-hmm. So of 8 of the 10, we're moving forwards on.
Yeah. And when I read through the document, am I right in thinking that it's proceeding under Scots law and US law?
Yes. So yes, right. It is. So again, sort of this was something that the first 4 years of the case we spent a lot of time fighting over, of whether it should be under Scottish law or New York law. Mm. It is under Scottish law for there's a sort of a, what they call it, a doctrine of internal affairs. So the internal affairs of the company should be governed by the law of where you're incorporated, and for us that was Scotland. So for things like the fiduciary duty, that's under Scots law, but for some other claims, they will be under New York law. So sort of events that happened out with the internal affairs of the company, those would be under New York law.
Where they pay a lot more out, yeah?
Not necessarily. It's, you know, again, it sort of depends. There's kind of the damages, like what the damages, but then there are other factors that kind of can result in what the final number is. Mm-hmm. But it's not, no, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. There's, under New York law, they do have punitive damages, which, you know, as it sounds, it can be quite punitive.
Okay.
And how long a piece of string? I know, but, you know, time frame, are you expecting stuff either
way? So basically timeline, we're in discovery at the moment. We expect that discovery will be completed by early next year. It is likely that the other side will file something called a motion summary judgment. Motion summary judgment is basically says to the court, look, now we have all of the evidence. This shouldn't go to trial because, you know, the evidence doesn't support our claims.
Right.
That typically will take, you know, probably 18 months. And then once you're through that stage, then the court will set a date. And so, you know, I think we're probably looking at late 2028. So it's about two and a half years to court, which feels fast now after, you know, another 8 years we've been at
this. I mean, 10 years on.
10 years on.
Yeah.
Not unknown in New York. Right. It is a very, very slow court system.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think on that, unless you've got any pressing questions, 10 years on, moving on slightly, but slightly related. So you, when you set up FanDuel, you were kind of, how do I put this? I'll stop. But some people may say you were kind of pushing the legal boundaries with loopholes, etc. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people banned it, some people regulated it. And some people could say that that's what prediction markets are doing. Mm-hmm. Some would just say they're completely bullshit. But, you know, what's your view on prediction markets in kind of general in terms of what they're doing? And then I've got a follow-up to that.
Yeah, let me actually touch on that characterization. I actually think that that's quite a British view of the legal system in the US. The legal and regulatory system in the US doesn't work like in the UK. In the UK, you've got like a gaming commission. If you came up with a new product, you go to the gaming commission, and the gaming commission goes, yeah, that's fine, or no, that we don't like that. The US doesn't really work like that. The way the US works is we have a whole body of sometimes conflicting laws. And we have state laws, and we have federal laws. And what happens is entrepreneurs go and look at those laws and says, you know what, we can do X. You know, like we did with FanDuel. We said, you know, fantasy sports seems to be clearly legal, and there's nothing in the definition that says that it has to last like 6 months. In fact, there's nothing that says that. All it says is that it has to be based on statistical results based on multiple games. Mm. Like, great. We can build a really fun product around that. And then what happens is the entrepreneurs build that. And then no one cares, like literally no one cares until you get to a real scale, and then suddenly lots of people care. Mm-hmm. And then lots of people scream and say, this is illegal, you know, this is a loophole, or this is clearly illegal. And then lots of people sue each other, and then things get resolved. This happened for DFS. It happened for DFS 2.0, like Prize Picks. Mm-hmm. It's happening for sweepstakes, and now it's happening for prediction markets. So it is very, very predictable, and it probably will happen for trading card vending machines and, you know, skill games and, like, really any category you think of. This is how it works in the U.S. Prediction markets is just one of the most recent instances of that. Okay.
I was just going to say, so do you feel like what we're seeing a lot with prediction markets is, well, I mean, even Trump's, you know, auto queue operator is being investigated for insider trading. We're seeing a lot of, you know, kind of potentially, like, you know, death markets, weather markets, you know, things that are kind of a bit close to the bone. I mean, are you saying that these kind of instances are just kind of like priced in to the process of kind of moving into a regulated market. It's a case of kind of almost like pushing the boundaries to see where the edge is.
Yeah, like, so when I describe it, what I'm sort of describing it, I'm saying there's pros and cons to that thing, that method of entrepreneurship. Like, I actually think I really quite like it because it means that people can sort of push the boundaries and sort of say, look, you know, the laws say this, let's be able to do this. Whereas it does feel like, I look at innovation in the UK gaming sector of the last 25 years, like how many startups in the last 25 years have really broken through in the UK? Like Midnight, you know, it's just, there's very few. It's really hard because you can't put together like a ton of lawyers to go into the Gaming Commission, and the Gaming Commission, it's much easier for them to just say no. Whereas in the US, we've just seen so much innovation. I think part of it is there's no gatekeeper to say that you can't do this. And it doesn't happen until you get to scale. Okay, so that's the positive. The downside is we see a lot of stuff in the US where, like, you look at it and go, well, this can't be right, you know, like in a moral sense, like, you know, death markets or insider trading. And so there's tons of sort of negativity. The question then is, what do I think of prediction markets? So personally, huge fan of prediction markets. Like, I was at work at Betfair sort of early 2000s. I helped relaunch BetDAC, and we also launched a betting exchange called BetDex in 2021. So, and even more crazily, FanDuel originally was a prediction market. So massive fan of the category. I think that it's and I also always felt that Betfair massively underperformed its opportunity. It's never going to dominate the market, but I think it should be a really big part of the betting mix. So I've always been a really big fan of it. I think what's happened in the US has sort of been fascinating, where basically they backdoored in through the CFTC. I don't think Congress ever really intended sports betting to be a federally regulated market by the CFTC. I don't think the CFTC really does any regulation of it.
No.
I think they've gone sort of completely laissez-faire. And like the result is the market's become really interesting, right? It's been, you know, the growth has been phenomenal. I think it's, as a consumer, I think it's fantastic. As a trader, I think it's brilliant. Like, the level of competition in the market's fantastic. But the challenge I see is, I don't think it's the CEA which created the ability for the CFTC to to basically magic wand these things as derivatives. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that it supports it. I don't think Congress ever intended the CFTC to be a regulator of sports betting that overstepped, states. So as a consumer and as somebody who follows the industry, I love it. But I do see a big challenge ahead of them, which is sort of a legal challenge that, and I think everyone sees that coming.
And then what's your view on crypto? Because, like, where does crypto sit into this, kind of mix? Because obviously, most recently you've been working on BetHog, which obviously is now shutting down at the end of this month.
Yeah, so crypto, I'm still, like, crypto definitely comes in waves, right? Like, we had, I think, 2017, 2021, and then we had a bit of a bull market last year. It feels like today we're in a little bit of a lull again.
Yeah.
I would never write crypto off. Today, the things we're seeing in this sort of bear market in crypto, payments is still incredible with crypto. Like, your ability to take payments anywhere, and that's what we find with BetHog, our ability to take payments anywhere in the world almost instantly, at almost zero cost. If you speak to any gaming operator, payments will be one of their biggest issues. And so that is one area where crypto, I think, is really strong. I think a lot of the hope in sort of 2021 of, like, decentralized protocols just hasn't really panned out. And I think there's a lot of people in crypto sort of rethinking some of the other use cases. I will say that, products like Hyperliquid, which is like a decentralized trading platform, I think that's been, you know, really successful. But I think there's been a bit of a reassessment within crypto at the moment, where, like, is this just really good payments, or is there a lot more here? Yeah. And I think the industry is still trying to figure out what the lot more is, because a lot of the things that we thought in 2021, even through to maybe last year, just haven't really delivered.
Okay, I mean, would you say BetHog falls into that?
Well, so BetHog, we started just like a year and a half ago, and what happened there was we were always very kind of product focused. We were like, look, we want to be really successful in the crypto casino space through building a better product, and we felt that we did. One of the things that we really discovered is in crypto is that we love building product, right? And that was kind of like, we just love building more product. We felt that B2C is much more of a marketing-driven business than it is product. Mm-hmm. Whereas with FanDuel, product was very core. It sort of went totally hand in hand. Whereas a crypto casino, it's sort of like, you know, I'd say it's 80% marketing and 20% product, right, or maybe 90% marketing and 10% product. And so BetHog was doing okay, but all of our focus was going on to building this AI dealer product. And so we basically, 3 months ago, launched B2B, went B2B with Sentient Studios. Mm-hmm. And then as we started working on it, we realized that all of our team was working on that. And that's where we wanted to put all our time and investment. And so that's why we decided to shut BetHog. BetHog was doing okay, but it wasn't what we were excited about. And it just, we didn't think that we could get where we wanted to without a lot more investment. And so we decided to focus on Sentient.
Because you're obviously launching kind of quite a few games through that. I mean, are they just being shuttered? Because obviously some of them...
They've rolled into Sentient now. So
right, okay.
Our two core games today are AI Blackjack and then AI Baccarat. We're working on a third game, which is AI-powered Roulette. Mm-hmm. And then we do have those other games as well, which we're thinking about how we would roll those into our B2B offering.
But is it fair just to, let's come across as rude, but bluntly, you know, you've had slots, then you had the RNG tables, so you just sat there playing blackjack. Then you had live, and everyone talks about live being the driver. Quite frankly, slots is still the biggest, and
of course,
most markets are actually slightly taking share over live. So really, it's just going, well, live's expensive, and people like it. We're just going back to RNG tables, which we've had for years, and just sticking an AI person just eating out. I mean, I think maybe a little bit more to that, but it's kind of taking over live, without.
Well, I think there is, it's an interesting point. Like, look, slot machine is probably one of the greatest gaming inventions in the last 50 years. Like, it's probably older than that now, actually, 70 years. You see so many gaming products start out with noble intent and they end up as a slot machine because slot machines are just so effective. What I would say is there is a group of people that love live dealer and they step away from slots and they play live dealer.
Oh, I find slots boring as hell, by the way. I do not understand how they're popular in real life, online. I think they're the most boring things in the world.
I kind of get slots, but I do have to get into the, okay, I get why but it's very, my dog's jumping in here. I get the appeal of slots. I think it's a much more, it's more of a immersive chill out type of game. Like, I think a lot of people, when they play the slots, they play to unwind as opposed to when I play, I play to heighten excitement. Slots, I think, is a much more of a, I want to chill. But so we do see the slots, obviously a huge category, and it's one of the dominant categories. Live dealer, we do find there's a cohort of people who actively pursue that. What we find with AI dealer is it actually, and then obviously we've got originals. And what we find with AI dealer is it actually fits somewhat more of AI originals in terms of reach. Originals tend to be the most mass market product. And what we find with AI dealer is, unlike live, so live can take several minutes to find a table. Also can be a little unnerving for players. Like they don't are like, oh, you know, I feel under pressure, which they don't get with originals. What we find with AI dealer is that it's much more like originals in that it's not unnerving. They can just pause. They can walk away, and so we are finding, and we see that in the player pattern. you know, with our live games, we find people come in and they just play long sessions. With our AI dealer, we do get that, but we'll also get people coming in and playing a few hands and dipping out again. We also get people will play lower value hands, and they'll do things that I don't think they would do on the live tables.
And if you're not allowed to say, like, we're going to take share from everywhere, you know, if I look at three buckets of, is your product growing the market? Is it replacing, you know, people who would use RNG tables?
Yeah.
Is it replacing live? I know you probably say, well, do all three of that. But to me, it seems as though the main thing's probably you're trying to kill the live, you know, just say you don't, it's almost as good as live or in some way better. And you don't have all these massive costs.
I think in the short term, we probably are growing the market. Was definitely a group of people that, you know, are intrigued by live, but they find it a little forbidding. In fact, we found a feature, users actually created a feature in our product, which was they would play in blackjack and it would be like a 16 against a 10. They don't really know what to do. And that the way they do is they would ask our dealers. And our dealers have been trained in basic strategy, so they would tell them what to do. You know, we'd never do that with a real live dealer, right? And I have no idea what they would tell you.
I do that in Vegas, and they'll say...
Oh, you do that in Vegas, right.
What the book says, and they say, play fair. I don't know if you win, but this is what the book says.
Yes, and so in Vegas they'll tell you, but I don't know, if you went on an Evolution dealer, would they tell you?
That's it. I mean, I don't know.
I doubt it. Yeah, well, I want to test. So we found that I think in the short term we are growing that market, of that sort of latent demand, but I think longer term, 100% we take share. There's no doubt in my mind. I also just feel, not to criticize anyone, but the live dealer product is 80 to 90% of the time dramatically worse than what I think the experience should be. You know, as a player, I go in and I kind of think that Vegas experience, I think of that really fun dealer that, you know, even though you lost, you kind of had a good experience. When I play on online live dealer, 90% of the time, I don't get anything even close to that. And that to me, creates an opportunity, because I actually think we can deliver that with AI powered dealers. Like, we can deliver somebody who is engaged, who has good audio quality, that is fun and is responsive to what I say. And that's not the experience I get with online live today, 90% of the time. And I think that's our opportunity.
So it's interesting, because obviously when the subject of AI dealers comes up, you know, like the big live dealer incumbents are obviously very against it.
Yeah.
For a number of...
They wanted banned is the one-to-one thing I heard recently.
I mean, that seems a bit wild, but do you feel there's any truth to that, in that, you know, there is a degree of AI fatigue in society? I mean, anyone who goes on LinkedIn will know it's a hellscape of, you know, ChatGPT posts and then ChatGPT responses. Yeah. But is there potentially, you know, an element of truth in that people are starting to kind of turn away and looking for, I suppose, an authentic experience, which is less about the kind of like the sheen behind it, more about the human interaction?
So, I think there's a couple of things to that. I think there absolutely is some sort of fatigue around AI slop. But the important part of that phrase is not AI, it's slop. It's bad content. Like, people hate bad content wherever it comes from. AI is just very good at creating lots of it very cheaply. And that's why, and we see this, but like, and then you'll know yourselves, people are using AI every day, frequently, multiple times a day. Even people that hate AI and want to shut down data centers had admitted recently they use AI to help them to figure out how to protest against a data center. And so...
Nigel, we have it the other way around. We had the minister who is in charge of AI and technology who admitted that she didn't use AI. And we also had the chancellor who on a Mumsnet thing was asked, you know, what AI program do you use? Because one of the main things in the UK is to increase efficiency, increase productivity to grow the economy.
Yeah.
She again admitted that she doesn't use AI at all. So
that's
at a government level, we don't know. That's just not used.
I feel the UK government is not the best test case for this one. But yeah, I, I've, I've been impressed with the AI technology at its ability to hit like grassroots of people that there's kind of certain technologies you see that are kind of pushed top down. And there's ones like AI, which like people are just naturally, and then Google just builds it into search. Like it's, I think some people use AI and they don't even know they're using AI. So like I Googled it and it gave me a response. Well, that's AI. So apart from government ministers, obviously, in the UK. But
maybe they're using it that way and they just didn't even
know. It's quite terrifying. So I think everyone hits slop, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that there's certain environments where authentic really matters. So like I look at a lot of AI applications. Like one example is my wife works in the therapy industry and I've looked at some of the AI therapy apps. I think that's really hard because I think people like want to have an authentic relationship with a therapist that an AI, even if it's really well trained, just cannot reach. So I think that's true. I think there's parts of the market where that's true. Live dealer is not one of those categories. I just, like, you go onto one of those tables, how often did you have an authentic social relationship with an online live dealer? Like, you know, you look at the chat logs, you go, every time I go on a table, I look how many people are chatting, zero, right? Maybe once or twice, or maybe one of the really big tables. And, you know, how social the experience, how engaged is the dealer in that? Like, almost never. So I do think that, I think this is one category where, like, the I think the social aspect is massively overrated. I also think that a very good AI-powered dealer can create social interaction between the table if that's the purpose. Most of the live dealers that I ever play with, they're not doing that. Like, they're just, like, you know, totally vanilla. It's mechanical. So we, in my view, what we've done with online live dealer is turned people into robots. And we can't then get annoyed if robots are better at doing it than the human robots that we've created. Like that's kind of, I think, where that market is today.
I suppose the only other bit, though, for me is my understanding is with certain people, like particularly prevalent in, let's say, Asia, for example, where live dealers are very big, who do it, not necessarily for the social interaction, but because they just don't trust RNG.
Yeah, it's very much a trust.
I think there's, and trust is probably one of the biggest factors, and I'd say two things for that. Number one, if you were playing in a like an Asian casino 10 years ago, you know, something, something, dot, X, stroke, you know, you probably would have trust issues, justifiably, right? Mm-hmm. That is less so today. Like, you look at Pragmatic, like, where's their top market? It's Asia, right? So I think that's changed. And then number two is there's other ways to resolve trust. Like, you can resolve it through provably fair, which is, you know, Stake has done that with originals. Like, all of the crypto casinos have done that with originals. You can also do it through brand. Like, why do I trust Hacksaw? Like, I have no idea what RNG Hacksaw uses. But it doesn't stop it from being incredibly successful or any of these slot titles. So I do think there is an argument around trust, but I think there's other ways to fix it.
And we
thing on trust, which I think is interesting. We've seen that in our testing with our product, which is as our product got higher fidelity and higher quality, people trusted it more. Right? This, in a way, you could say this doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you trust it just because the product quality is higher? But in a way, it kind of does make sense, which is the product looks kind of slocky, then I could be getting scammed. But if it's clearly people have invested millions of dollars into it, they're more likely to be legitimate and they've spent time and refining it. So humans are kind of interesting, right? I tell you, building for humans is really interesting, but that's trust doesn't just come from, you know, I'd say, honestly, if I go into some of our like the live dealer competitors, not an evolution, but like one of these sort of schlocky tier three ones, I have trust issues. I'm like, I see the cards, but I don't know. Like, this doesn't feel like, this feels like backroom kind of stuff.
Yeah. So we are definitely coming up on time, but one of the things I always think is quite interesting when people talk about AI is, generally, like broadly speaking, in public, it's talked about, you know, an efficiency driver, it can do things quicker, all this kind of stuff. But it feels like when it's being used properly, it's not quicker, it's not, you know, cheaper.
Yeah.
But it does potentially create a better product. Is that fair? Is that kind of that tally with what you think?
I'd say your experience, the developers, and then in design is, it is an efficiency driver, but it's not like the 5-10x that some people sort of claim. It's sort of like an incremental efficiency gain. It's very good at certain things. So prototyping, unbelievable. And there you can see a 10x increase in increase. But if you want to have a production grade product, it's more incremental improvement, maybe a 20% improvement, productivity gain. One of the things I would say is interesting now is we are hitting the point. So AI Dealer is an example of a product that couldn't exist without AI. Whereas a lot of the AI up until quite recently were products that you could have had before. Mm-hmm. They were just, you know, you can build them a little faster, right? And so I think we're now at an interesting point now. We will see more products that could only be done with AI as opposed to ones that you could do. So for example, you know, if you remember like a lot of the sort of AI videos, like those could be done before. It's just a lot cheaper to do now. What we're really excited about are products like AI Dealer, where you can ask the dealer, like, it's a 16 against 10, what should I do? I can only do that with AI. I think we're going to see more and more products like that. I think that's really exciting.
Don't you bloody start burking me.
Nigel, I think this has been fascinating. I have to go, but Robin can carry on. But I would actually happily continue talking to you for at least half an hour, particularly my views on prediction markets and what I think FanDuel and DraftKings are doing by just pretty much, I think, being saved as companies by PASPA and then just going, oh, well, we're just going to ignore it when it suits us, is completely out of order. Yeah. And there's so much I want to do. So I'd love a follow-up at some point. And it's been a super interesting guest. And sorry I'm having to drop off.
Yeah, genuinely.
All the best with the new one. I think it'll be interesting to see that because, yeah, Live Dealer, I always thought, is the investor, from the investor side and everything else, it's always talked up more than its performance, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So let's see how yours goes.
It's great, thank you.
Right, well, we're definitely up in time then. I think that's the first time that Ed has actually ever said that he would like to spend more time with the guest, even if he did limit it to at least half an hour.
Yeah.
But no, Nigel, as Ed says, thank you so much for joining us and really appreciate it. And everyone, thank you for listening. It's been a bumper episode. I mean, usually when we do them this long, it's just me and Ed talking. So this one's actually got some good stuff in it. So thank you very much for listening and we'll see you in the next one.